within earshot of Terran. Valdez got up and excused himself and then walked with Bosch into the hallway. "So did you get a chance to talk to Bella and find out what happened?" Bosch asked. "Briefly," Valdez said. "She's in bad shape emotionally, and I just didn't want to put her through it. I mean, there's no hurry, is there?"
"No."
"Anyway, she said she went over to the yard about noon and nobody was around because it was lunchtime. She went into the offices and found Dockweiler eating at his desk. When she asked about the metal detector, he volunteered to put it in a truck and take it up there to the house. And she said yes, because I wasn't there to help." "Don't beat yourself up. You told her to take Sisto. And besides, Dockweiler, no matter what kind of an asshole he is a former cop. She had no reason to feel unsafe."
"So when did he grab her?"
"They went to the house and searched. The metal detector was heavy, and he volunteered to drive it up in a city truck and operate it. You were right. There were keys in the bushes. She just didn't know they were his. He had parked the truck in the back by the garage, so it was pretty secluded. The victim from the attempted assault Friday had not come back yet, and there was nobody around. He asked her to help him get the metal detector back in the truck, and that's when he grabbed her from behind and choked her out. He must have drugged her then, because she was out a long time. When she woke up, she was already down in that dungeon, and he was on top of her. He was rough. She's pretty banged up." Bosch shook his head. It was impossible to imagine what Lourdes had experienced. "The sick fuck," Valdez said. "He told her he was going to keep her alive down there. He said she would never see sunlight again." Bosch was rescued from the grim details by Terran, who entered the hallway looking for him.
"I just went back to tell her you were here," she said to Bosch. "She's awake and wants to see you."
"She doesn't have to see me," Bosch said. "I don't want to intrude."
"No, she wants to. Really."
"Okay, then."
Terran led Bosch back through the waiting room and into another hallway. As they walked, she shook her head in anguish.
"She's tough," Bosch said. "She'll get through this."
"No, that's not it," Terran said.
"Then what?"
"I just can't believe that he's here, too."
Bosch was confused.
"The chief?"
"No, Dockweiler. They have him in this hospital."
Now Bosch got it.
"Does Bella know?"
"I don't think so."
"Well, don't tell her."
"I wouldn't. It would freak her the fuck out."
"As soon as he's stabilized, they'll move him. They have a jail hospital down at County USC. He'll go there."
"Good."
They came to an open door and entered a private room, where Lourdes lay in a bed with side guards up. She was turned away from the door, gazing at the room's window. Her hands lay limply at her sides. Without looking at her visitors, she asked Terran to give them privacy. Terran left and Bosch stood there. He could only see Bella's left eye, but could tell it was swollen and bruised. She also had swelling and a bite mark on her lower lip.
"Hey, Bella," he finally said.
"I guess I owe you that beer you were talking about," she said.
Bosch remembered telling her she would owe him if she found something with a metal detector.
"Bella, I should have been there with you," he said.
"I am so sorry. I messed up and you paid an awful price."
"Don't be silly," she said. "You didn't mess up. I did. I should never have turned my back on him."
She finally looked at him. There was hemorrhaging around both eyes from when Dockweiler had choked her. She turned a hand up on the bed, an invitation to hold it. Bosch moved closer and squeezed her hand, trying somehow to communicate what he couldn't find the words to say.
"Thanks for coming," she said, "and for saving me. The chief told me."
"You, I would have guessed. Sisto? That was a surprise."
She tried to smile. Bosch shrugged.
"You solved the case," he said. "Saved a lot of other women from him. Remember that."
She nodded and closed her eyes. Bosch could see tears.
"Harry, I have to tell you something," she said.
"What is it?" he asked.
She looked up at him again.
"He made me tell him about you. He hurt me, and I tried, but I couldn't take it. He wanted to know how we knew about the keys, and about you. He wanted to know if you had a wife or kids. I tried to hold out, Harry."
Bosch squeezed her hand.
"Don't say any more, Bella," he said. "You did great. We got the guy, and it's over now. That's all that matters."
She closed her eyes again.
I'm going to go back to sleep now, she said.
Sure, he said. I'll be back soon, Bella. You hang in there.
Bosch headed down the hall, thinking about Dockweiler's torturing Bella to get information about him. He wondered where that would have led if things hadn't ended that night. In the waiting room, Bosch found Valdez, but no Taryn. The chief explained that she went home to get clothes for Bella for when she was released, whenever that would be. They spoke about the screen cutter case and what needed to be completed on their end for both the sheriff's shooting investigation and the prosecution of Dockweiler. They had 48 hours to present their case against the suspected rapist to the DA's office and ask for charges. Because Lourdes was out of commission in the hospital, Bosch was going to have to be point.
I want this case to be airtight, Harry, Valdez said. And I want to hit him with everything we can, every charge possible. I don't want him ever breathing free air again.
Got it, Bosch said. That's not going to be a problem. I'm going to go home, sleep till about noon, and then I'll get back on it.
Valdez clapped him on the upper arm in encouragement.
Let me know what you need, he said.
You're staying here? Bosch asked.
Yeah, for a while. Sisto texted and said he wanted to come by. I think I'll wait for him. When this thing levels out, we need to all get together for some beers, make sure everybody's okay.
That'll be good.
Bosch left the hospital then and ran into Sisto in the parking garage. He was in fresh clothes and looked like he might even have gotten some sleep.
How's Bella? He asked.
I don't really know, Bosch said. She's been through a kind of hell that's hard to imagine.
Did you see her?
For a few minutes. The chief's up there in the waiting room. He'll get you in if he can.
Cool.
See you back at the bureau. I'm going to go home and sleep first.
Sisto nodded and walked off.
Bosch thought of something and then called after him.
Hey, Sisto.
The young detective walked back.
Yeah, listen. I'm sorry for losing my cool and pushing you, Bosch said. And throwing your phone. It was just a tense situation, you know?
No, man, it was cool, Sisto said.
You were right. I don't want to be a fuck-up, Harry. I want to be a good detective like you.
Bosch nodded his thanks for the compliment.
Don't worry, he said. You'll get there. And you did good work last night.
Thanks. You want to do something after you see Bella?
What do you mean?
Go over to Public Works and tape off Dockweiler's desk. We'll need to go through it. Then get the supervisor over there to pull records on all code inspections he did over the last 4 years. You're looking for unpermitted dwellings.
You think that's how he picked the victims?
I guarantee it.
Pull all of those and put them on my desk.
I'll go through them when I get in and put them on the streets where our victims lived.
Cool. We need a warrant?
I don't think so.
Public records.
Okay, Harry. I'm on it.
They'll be on your desk.
Bosch gave him a fist bump, then headed off to his car. Chapter 35. Bosch went home, took a long shower, and then crawled into his bed for what he intended to be a 4-hour nap. He even tied a bandana around his head and over his eyes to keep out the light of day. But less than 2 hours into a deep trench of sleep, he was awakened by a blaring guitar riff. He yanked the bandana off and tried to do the same thing with the vestiges of sleep. Then clarity came, and he realized it was the ringtone his daughter had programmed into his phone, so he would know when she was calling. Black Sun by Death Cab for Cutie. She had programmed it into her own phone for his calls to her as well. He grabbed at the phone, knocking it off the bed table to the floor before finally picking it up and answering.
Maddie, what's wrong?
Nothing. What's wrong with you?
You sound weird.
I was sleeping.
What's going on?
Well, I thought we were maybe going to have lunch today. Are you still at your hotel?
Shoot, I'm sorry, Maddie. I forgot to call you. I'm back home. I got called back last night on an emergency. An officer got abducted, and we worked all night on it.
Holy shit, abducted? Did you get him back?
It was a she, and yes, we got her back. But it was a long night, and I'm just catching up. I think I'm going to be kind of busy for a few days. Can we do lunch or dinner this weekend or early next week?
Yeah, no worries. But how was she abducted?
It's kind of a long story, but he was a wanted guy, and he sort of grabbed her before she grabbed him. But we got her back. He's under arrest, and everything's okay.
He left the explanation short because he didn't want her to know the details of what had happened to Bella Lourdes or that he had shot or abducted her. That would make for a long conversation.
Well, good. I guess then I'll let you get back to sleep.
Did you have classes this morning?
Psychology and Spanish. I'm finished for the day.
That's nice.
Dad?
Yeah. I kind of also wanted to say I was sorry about what I said yesterday about the restaurant and everything. I didn't know your reasons, and it kind of sucked that I jumped on you.
I'm really sorry.
Don't worry about it, baby. You didn't know, and it's all right.
So we're cool?
We're cool.
Love you, Dad. Now go to sleep.
She laughed.
What?
That's what you used to say to me when I was little.
Love you. Now go to sleep.
I remember that. After disconnecting, Bosch pulled the bandana back over his eyes and tried to go back to sleep. And failed. 20 minutes into the effort, with the Death Cab guitar hook and earworm playing in his head, he gave up on finding the sleep trench again and got out of bed. He took another quick shower to refresh himself and headed back north to San Fernando. The number of media trucks outside the police station had doubled since the week before when the screen cutter was just a wanted man. Now that he had been identified, had abducted one cop, and had been shot by another, the case was big news. Bosch went in the side door as usual and was able to escape notice from the reporters gathered in the front lobby. The department's media officer was usually the captain, as part of his catch-all duties. But Bosch assumed Trevino would not be the point man on a story he had played a significant part in. He suspected the media management on this story would fall to Sergeant Rosenberg, who was affable and telegenic in a cop sort of way. He looked like a cop and talked like a cop, and that's what the media wanted. The detective bureau was deserted, and that was the way Bosch needed it. After an event like that of the night before, people tended to want to talk. They'd gather around the desk and tell it from their point of view, listen to it from somebody else's point of view. It was therapeutic. But Bosch didn't want to talk. He wanted to work. He had to write what he knew would be a lengthy and detailed charging document that would be first scrutinized by his superiors in the department, then by multiple prosecutors with the district attorney's office, and then a defense lawyer, and eventually even the media. He wanted focus, and the quiet detective bureau would be perfect. Sisto wasn't in the bureau, but his presence was immediately felt. When Bosch got to his desk and dropped his car keys, he found 4 neat stacks of code inspection reports waiting for him. The young detective had come through. Bosch sat down to work and almost immediately felt the weight of exhaustion settle onto him. He had not gotten enough rest after the events of the night before. His shoulder was aching from the impact of the curtain frame in Dockweiler's fallout shelter, but where he was feeling it most was in his legs. That run back up the slope of the wash was the first time he had fired the pistons in a long time, and he was sore and fatigued. He signed into the computer, opened a blank document, and left it ready while he went down the hallway to the station's kitchen. On the way, he passed the open door of the chief's office and saw Valdez seated at his desk, the telephone to his ear. The snippet of conversation he heard was enough for Bosch to know the chief was talking to a reporter, saying that the department was not going to identify the officer who had been abducted because she was the victim of a sexual assault. Bosch thought that in a department as small as San Fernando's, it would not take a good reporter more than a few calls to figure out who was being protected. That would result in reporters camped on the front lawn of Bella Lourdes' house, unless her address was protected by being deeded in Taryn's name. There was a fresh pot of coffee already brewed, and Bosch poured 2 cups, leaving both black. On the way back to the bureau, he stopped by the open door of the chief's office and held up one as an offer. Valdez nodded and covered the phone to respond.
Harry, you're the man.
Bosch stepped into the office and put the cup down on the desk.
Knock him dead, chief.
5 minutes later, Bosch was back in his cubicle and was going through the inspection reports. It only took him an hour because once he became familiar with the form, he was able to quickly go through it and identify the street where each inspection took place. He was looking for the 5 streets where the known victims, including Beatrice Sahagun, lived. At the end of the hour, he had placed Dockweiler on each victim's street in the months before her assault or attempted assault. In 2 of the cases, he had actually inspected the victim's home, as long as 9 months earlier.
The information garnered from the reports helped draw a solid picture of Dockweiler's M.O. Bosch believed that he first saw the victims while conducting inspections, then stalked them, and carefully planned the assaults for weeks, and sometimes months. As a code inspector and former police officer, he had skills that aided this process. Bosch had no doubt that Dockweiler entered and prowled the homes of the victims, possibly even while they were at home and asleep. Finished with the code inspection piece of the puzzle, Bosch began writing the charging document. He was a two-finger typist, but he was fast just the same, especially when he knew and was confident in the story he wanted to tell. He worked another 2 hours without a break, or even a look-up from the computer screen. When he was finished, he took a gulp of cold black coffee and hit the print button. The universal printer on the other side of the room spit out 6 single-space pages of a chronology that began first with the screen cutter rape 4 years earlier and ended with Kurt Dockweiler lying face down on his kitchen floor with a bullet lodged in his spine. Bosch proofed it with a red pen, made the corrections on his computer, and printed it again. He then took it to the chief's office, where he found him talking on the phone to yet another reporter. He covered the receiver again.
USA Today, he said. This story is going coast to coast.
Make sure they spell your name right, Bosch said. I'm going to need you to read and approve this. I want a file on Dockweiler first thing tomorrow morning. I'm going for 5 counts of forcible rape, 1 count attempted rape, then kidnapping, assault with a deadly weapon, and multiple counts of theft of government property.
The kitchen sink approach. I like it.
Let me know. I have to go write up the evidence report and the search warrant that we got approved last night. Bosch was about to leave the office when Valdez held up a finger, then returned to his phone call.
Donna, I need to go, he said. You have the details in the press release, and like I said, we're not putting out either officer's name at this time. We took a really bad character out of circulation. We're all very proud of that. Thank you.
Valdez hung up the phone, even as he and Bosch could hear the reporter's voice asking another question.
All day long, Valdez said. They're calling from all over the place. Everybody wants to get photos of the dungeon. Everybody wants to talk to Bella and you.
I heard you on the phone earlier when you used that word dungeon, Bosch said. That's how things take on a whole new life in the media. It's a fallout shelter, not a dungeon.
Well, as soon as Dockweiler has a lawyer, he can sue me.
These reporters. One of them told me the average cost of incarcerating an inmate is $30,000 a year, but with Dockweiler likely being a paraplegic now, it will double for him.
I said, so what are you saying? We should have just executed him on the spot to save money?
We did have our chance.
I'll forget you said that, Harry. I don't even want to think about what you were going to do to him last night.
Just what was necessary to find Bella.
Well, we did anyway.
We got lucky.
That wasn't luck. That was good detective work. Anyway, you should be ready. They're trying to find out who the shooter was, and when they learn it was you, they'll connect it to West Hollywood last year and everything else before. Be prepared.
I'll take a vacation and disappear.
Good idea.
So this is good to go? He had picked up the document Bosch had delivered.
You tell me, Bosch said.
Okay, give me 15 minutes, Valdez said.
By the way, where's the captain been all day? Sleeping?
No, he's staying at the hospital with Bella. I wanted someone there to keep the media away, and in case she needed anything.
Bosch nodded.
It was a good move. He told Valdez that he would be in the bureau, and to call or email if he wanted any changes to the charging document. He returned to his computer in the detective bureau. He was just putting the finishing touches on a report summarizing the physical evidence they had amassed in the case when his cell phone buzzed. It was Mickey Haller calling.
Yo, bro. Haven't heard from you, the lawyer said. You talked to the granddaughter yet?
The Vance case had been so thoroughly crowded out of Bosch's mind with the events of the past 18 hours that it seemed like his trip to San Diego had been a month ago.
No, not yet, Bosch said.
What about Ida Parks, whatever her name is, Haller asked.
Ida Towns Forsythe.
No, haven't gotten to her yet either. Things have sort of been crazy with my other job.
Holy shit. You're on that thing with the guy in the dungeon up there in Santa Clorox?
It was an old nickname for Santa Clarita, reflecting its early incarnation as a destination for white flight from Los Angeles. It seemed somehow inappropriate coming from a guy Bosch knew grew up in Beverly Hills,
the county's first bastion of white isolationism and privilege.
Yes, I'm on the case, Bosch said.
Tell me, is the guy hooked up with a lawyer yet? Haller asked.
Bosch hesitated before answering.
You don't want to go there, he said.
Hey, I'll go anywhere, Haller said.
Half case will travel.
But you're right. This probate stuff may keep me occupied for a while.
They file probate on Vance yet?
Nope.
Waiting.
Well, I should be back on that sometime tomorrow. When I find the granddaughter, I'll let you know.
Bring her in, Harry. I'd like to meet her.
Bosch didn't answer. His attention was drawn to his screen, where he had just received an email from Valdez approving his case summary and charging affidavit. He now had to finish the evidence report and search warrant, and he would be good to go.
Chapter 36. On Wednesday morning, Bosch was at the district attorney's office as soon as the doors opened. Because it was a high-profile case, he had arranged to come in for an appointment to file charges against Dockweiler. Rather than going to an intake prosecutor who would file the case and then pass it on, never to see it again, the Dockweiler prosecution was assigned from the start to a veteran trial attorney named Dante Corvallis. Bosch had never worked with Corvallis previously, but knew of him by reputation. His nickname in the courthouse was the Undefeated, because he had never lost a case. The process of filing went smoothly, with Corvallis only rejecting Bosch's request for charges relating to the property crimes Dockweiler had committed. The prosecutor explained that it would already be a complicated case with the testimony of multiple victims and DNA analysis to explain to the jury. There was no need to spend prep time or court time on Dockweiler's theft of tools, concrete, and a manhole cover from the Department of Public Works. That simply was small-time stuff that might create jury backlash.
It's the effect of TV, Corvallis said. Every trial you see on the box lasts an hour. Juries on real cases get impatient, so you can't over-prosecute a case. And the bottom line is, we don't need it. We've got enough here to put him away forever, and we will. So let's forget about the manhole cover, except for when you testify about finding Bella. It will be a nice detail to draw out in your testimony.
Bosch couldn't argue the point. He was happy to just have one of the office's major players on the case from the start. Bosch and Corvallis agreed to set a schedule of meeting every Tuesday to discuss preparations for the case. Bosch was out of the Foltz building by 10. Rather than go to his car, he walked down Temple and then crossed over the 101 freeway at Main Street. He walked through Paseo de la Plaza Park and then down Olivera Street to the Mexican Bazaar, assuring himself that he could not be followed by car. At the end of the long passage through the souvenir stalls, he turned and looked back to see if he had a tail on foot. Satisfied after several minutes that he was alone, he continued anti-surveillance measures by crossing Alameda and entering Union Station. He passed through the giant waiting room and then took a circuitous path to the roof, where he pulled a TAP card out of his wallet and got on the Metro's Gold Line. He studied every person on the train as it left Union Station and headed into Little Tokyo. At the first stop, he exited the train, but then paused next to the sliding door. He checked every other commuter who got off, and none seemed suspicious. He stepped back onto the train to see if any of them did the same, waited until the bell warned that the doors were closing, and jumped off at the last moment. No one followed. He walked two blocks down Alameda, and then cut in toward the river. The address he had for Viviana Veracruz put her studio on Hewitt near Traction in the heart of the Arts District. Circling back to Hewitt, he repeatedly stopped and checked his surroundings. Along the way, he passed several old commercial structures that were restored or in the process of being restored for use as loft homes. The Art District was more than a neighborhood. It was a movement. Beginning almost 40 years earlier, artists of all disciplines started to take over millions of square feet of empty space in the abandoned factories and fruit shipping warehouses that had thrived in the area before World War II. Paying pennies per foot for massive live workspaces, some of the city's most notable artists thrived here. It seemed appropriate that the movement was anchored in an area where in the early 1900s, artists had vied to design the colorful images that graced the crates and boxes of fruit shipped across the country, popularizing a recognizable California style that said life was good on the West Coast. It was one of the small things that helped inspire the wave of westward movement that now made California the most populous state in the Union.
The Arts District now faced many of the issues that came with success, namely the swift spread of gentrification. In the past decade, the area started drawing big developers interested in big profits. The cost of a square foot of space was no longer measured in pennies, but in dollars. Many of the new tenants were upscale professionals who worked in downtown or Hollywood and wouldn't know the difference between a stippling and a stencil brush. Many of the restaurants went upscale and had celebrity chefs and valet parking that cost more than a whole meal in the older corner cafes where artists once congregated. The idea of the district being a haven for the starving artist was becoming more and more unfounded. As a young patrol officer in the early 70s, Bosch had been assigned to Newton Division, which included what was then called the Warehouse District. He remembered the area as a barren wasteland of empty buildings, homeless encampments, and street crime. He had transferred to Hollywood Division before the arts renaissance had begun. Now, as he walked through, he marveled at the changes. There was a difference between a mural and a piece of graffiti. Both were arguably works of art, but the murals in the Arts District were beautiful and showed care and vision, similar to those he had seen a few days earlier down in Chicano Park. He passed by the American, a building more than 100 years old, that originally served as a hotel for black entertainers during segregation, and later was ground zero for both the arts movement and the burgeoning punk rock scene in the 1970s. Viviana Vera Cruz lived and worked across the street in a building that had once been a cardboard plant. It was where many of the wax fruit boxes with labels that served as California's calling cards were produced. It was 4 stories tall, with brick cladding and steel-framed warehouse windows still intact. There was a brass plaque next to the entrance that stated its history and the year of its construction, 1908. There was no security or lock on the entrance. Bosch entered a small tiled lobby and checked a board that listed artists and their loft numbers. Bosch found the name Veracruz next to 4D. He also saw on a community bulletin board several notices about tenant and neighborhood meetings regarding issues like rent stabilization and protesting building permit applications at City Hall. There were sign-up lists, and he saw the name Vib scrawled on all of these. There was also a flyer for a showing of a documentary film called Young Turks on Friday evening in Loft 4D. The flyer said the film was about the founding of the Arts District in the 1970s. "See this place before the greed," the flyer trumpeted. It appeared to Bosch that Viviana Vera Cruz had inherited some of the community activism that had charged her mother's life. With his legs still feeling the pain of his run up the slope 2 nights before, Bosch didn't want to walk up 3 flights of stairs. He found a freight elevator with a pull-down door and rode up to the 4th floor at a turtle's pace. The elevator was the size of his living room, and he felt self-conscious about riding up alone and wasting what must have been an enormous amount of energy to move the platform. It was obviously a design element left over from the building's early incarnation as a cardboard factory. The top floor was quartered into 4 live-work lofts, accessible off an industrial gray lobby. The lower half of the door to 4D was plastered with cartoon stickers, obviously placed haphazardly by a small person, Viviana's son, Harry assumed. Above this was a card posted with hours when Viviana Vera Cruz would receive patrons and viewers of her art. On Wednesday, those hours were from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., and that put Bosch 15 minutes early. He considered just knocking on the door, since he was not there with the purpose of seeing her art. But he was also hopeful that he could somehow take a measure of the woman before he decided how to tell her she might be heir to a fortune with more zeros attached to it than she could imagine. While deciding what to do, he heard someone coming up the stairs next to the elevator shaft. A woman soon appeared, carrying a frozen coffee drink in one hand and a key in the other. She wore overalls and had a breathing mask down around her neck. She looked surprised to see a man waiting at her door. "Hi," she said. "Hi," Bosch said. "Can I help you?" Are you Viviana Vera Cruz?" He knew it was her. There was a clear resemblance to Gabriella in the Coronado Beach photos. But he pointed at the door to 4D, as if he had to back up his presence with the posted hours. "I am," she said. "Well, I'm early," he said. "I didn't know your hours. I was hoping to look at some of your work." "That's okay. You're close enough. I can show you around. What's your name?" "Harry Bosch."
She looked like she recognized the name, and Bosch wondered if her mother had found a way to contact her after promising she wouldn't attempt to.
"That's a famous artist's name," she said. "Hieronymus Bosch."
Bosch suddenly realized his mistake. "I know," he said. 15th century. It's actually my full name." She used a key to unlock her door. She looked back at him over her shoulder.
"You're kidding, right?"
"No. You had some strange parents." She opened the door.
"Come on in," she said. "I only have a few pieces here at the moment. There's a gallery over on Violet that has a couple more, and then there are a couple out at Bergamot Station.
How did you hear about me?" Bosch hadn't prepared a story, but he knew Bergamot Station was a conglomeration of galleries housed in an old rail station in Santa Monica. He had never been there, but quickly adopted it as a cover.
"I saw your pieces at Bergamot," he said. "I had some business downtown this morning, and thought I would see what else you have."
"Cool," Vera Cruz said. "Well, I'm Vib." She reached out a hand, and they shook. Her hand was rough and calloused. The loft was quiet as he entered, and Bosch assumed her son was in school. There was a sharp smell of chemicals that reminded Bosch of the fingerprint lab, where they used cyanacrylate to fume objects and raise prints. She gestured to her right and behind Bosch. He turned and saw that the front space of the loft was used as her studio and gallery. Her sculptures were large, and Bosch could see how the freight elevator and the 20-foot ceilings here gave her freedom to go big. Three finished pieces sat on wheeled pallets so they could easily be moved. Movie night on Friday would probably be in this space after the sculptures were moved out of the way. There was also a work area with two benches and racks of tools. A large block of what looked like foam rubber was on a pallet, and it appeared that an image of a man was emerging from a sculpting process. The finished pieces were multi-figure dioramas made of pure white acrylic. All were variations on the nuclear family. Mother, father, and daughter. The interaction of the three was different in each sculpture, but in each the daughter was looking away from her parents and had no clearly defined face. There were nose and brow ridges, but no eyes or mouth. One of the dioramas showed the father as a soldier with several equipment packs, but no weapon. His eyes were closed. Bosch could see a resemblance to the photos he had seen of Dominic Santinello. Bosch pointed to the diorama with the father as soldier figure. "What is this one about?" he asked.
"What is it about?" Vera Cruz repeated.
"It's about war and the destruction of families. But I don't really think my work needs explanation. You absorb it and you feel something or you don't. Art shouldn't be explained." Bosch just nodded. He felt he had blundered with his question.
"You probably noticed that this one is the companion piece to the two you saw at Bergamot," Vera Cruz said.
Bosch nodded again, but in a more vigorous manner, as if to communicate that he knew what she was talking about. Her saying so, however, made him want to go to Bergamot and see the other two. He kept his eyes on the sculptures and walked further into the room to see them from different angles. Bosch could tell that it was the same girl in all three pieces, but her ages were different.
"What are the ages of the girl?" he asked.
11, 13, and 15, Vera Cruz said.
"Very observant."
He guessed that the incomplete face on each had to do with abandonment, not knowing one's origin, being one of the faceless and nameless. He knew what that was like.
"Very beautiful," he said.
He meant it sincerely.
"Thank you," she said.
"I didn't know my father," he said. It startled him when it came out. It wasn't part of his cover. The power of the sculptures made him say it.
"I'm sorry," she said.
"I only met him one time," he said. "I was 21 and I had just come back from Vietnam." He gestured toward the war sculpture.
"I tracked him down," he said. "Knocked on his door. I was glad I did it. He died soon after."
"I supposedly met my father one time when I was a baby. I don't remember it. He died soon after, too. He was lost in the same war."
"I'm sorry."
"Don't be. I'm happy. I have a child and I have my art. If I can keep this place from falling into greedy hands, then all will be perfect."
"You mean the building? It's for sale?"
"It's sold, pending the city's approval to change it into residential. The buyer wants to cut every loft into two, get rid of the artists, and get this, call it the River Arts Residences."
Bosch thought for a long moment before responding. She had given him the opening.
What if I told you there was a way to do that? He asked. Keep things perfect.
When she didn't answer, he turned and looked at her. Then she did speak.
Who are you? She asked.
Chapter 37 Viviana Veracruz was stunned to silence when Bosch told her who he was and what he was doing. He showed her his credentials as a state-licensed private investigator. He didn't mention Whitney Vance by name, but told her that he had tracked her through her father's lineage and believed she and her son were the only two heirs by blood to an industrial fortune. It was she who brought up Vance, having seen media stories in the past few days about the passing of the billionaire industrialist.
Is that who we're talking about here? She asked. Whitney Vance?
What I want to do is confirm the link genetically before we get into names, Bosch said. If you're open to it, I would take a sample of your DNA through a saliva swab and turn it into the lab. It should only take a few days, and if we get confirmation, you would have the opportunity to use the attorney I have working with me on this, or to seek your own representation. That would be your choice. She shook her head, as if still not comprehending, and sat down on a stool she had pulled away from one of the workbenches.
It's just so hard to believe this, she said.
Bosch remembered a television show from when he was a kid, in which a man traveled the country and gave checks for $1 million from an unknown benefactor to unsuspecting recipients. He realized he felt like that man. Only Bosch was handing out billions, not millions.
It is Vance, isn't it? Viviana said. You haven't denied it.
Bosch looked at her for a long moment.
Does it make a difference who it is? He asked.
She stood up and came toward him. She gestured at the sculpture with the soldier.
I read about him this week, she said. He helped build the helicopters. His company was part of the war machine that killed his own son. My father, who I never got to know.
How could I take that money? Bosch nodded. I guess it would depend on what you did with it, he said. My lawyer called it change the world money. She looked at him, but he could tell she was seeing something else. Maybe an idea that was planted by his words.
All right, she said. Swab me.
Okay, but you have to understand something, Bosch said. There will be people with power involved in the corporations that currently hold his fortune. They will not be happy to part with it, and may go to great lengths to stop it. Not only will your life be changed by the money, but you and your son will have to take measures to protect yourselves until the case runs its course. You will not be able to trust anyone. His words clearly gave her pause as he wanted them to.
Gilberto, she said, thinking out loud.
Then her eyes flashed toward Bosch.
Do they know you're here?
I've taken precautions, he said, and I'll give you a card. If you see anything unusual or feel any kind of threat, you can call me at any time.
It's so surreal, she said. When I was coming up the steps today with my coffee, I was thinking about how I didn't have enough money for resin. I haven't sold any of my art in 7 weeks, and I have an arts grant, but it just covers living for me and my son. So I'm sculpting my next piece, but can't get the material I need to wrap it and finish it.
And then you were just standing there, and you had this crazy story about money and inheritance.
Bosch nodded. So should we do the swab now, he asked.
Yes, she said. What do I do?
You just have to open your mouth.
I can do that.
Bosch took a tube out of his inside coat pocket and unscrewed the cap. He removed the swab stick and stepped closer to Viviana. Holding the stick with two fingers, he wiped the swab end up and down the inside of her cheek, turning it to get a good sample. He then sealed the stick back in its tube.
You usually do two, just in case, he said. Do you mind?
Go ahead, she said.
Bosch repeated the process. It seemed so intrusive to him, his hand so close to her mouth. But Viviana seemed unfazed by it. He put the second swab back in its tube and sealed it.
I took a swab from your mother on Monday, he said. It will be part of the analysis. They will want to identify her chromosomes and separate them from your father's and grandfather's.
You went down to San Diego, she asked.
Yes, I went by Chicano Park, and then over to her apartment.
Is that where you grew up?
Yes. She's still in the same place.
I showed her a photo. It was of you on that day you met your father. He's not in it because he was the one who took it.
I'd like to see that.
I don't have it with me, but I'll get it to you. So she knows about this, the inheritance.
What did she say?
She doesn't know the details, but she told me where to find you and said it was your choice. Bibiana didn't respond. She seemed to be thinking about her mother. I'm going to go now, Bosch said. I'll be in touch as soon as I know something. He handed her one of the cheap business cards he'd had printed with his name and number, then turned toward the door. Bosch made his way back to his car, which he had left parked in a lot near the courthouse before his appointment at the DA's office. As he walked, he repeatedly checked his perimeter for surveillance. He saw nothing, and soon he was back to the rented Cherokee. He opened the rear hatch of the SUV and flipped up the rug liner in the back. He lifted the lid of the spare tire and tools compartment and removed the padded envelope he had put there that morning. Closing up the back, he got in behind the wheel and opened the padded envelope. It contained the swab tube provided by Whitney Vance and marked WV. It also contained two tubes collected from Gabrielle Alita, marked GL. With a Sharpie marker, he wrote VV on the side of the two tubes containing the swabs he had just collected from Bibiana. He put the extra tubes from Bibiana and her mother into his coat pocket and repackaged the envelope so it contained one swab from each of the principals. He put the envelope down on the seat next to him and called Mickey Howler. I have the granddaughter's sample, he said. Where are you? In the car, Howler said. The Starbucks in Chinatown, parked under the Dragon. I'll be there in 5. I have hers, her mother's, and Vance's with me. You can take the package to the lab. Perfect. They open probate today in Pasadena, so I want to get this going. Need confirmation before we make a move. On my way. The Starbucks was at Broadway and Cesar Chavez. It took Bosch less than 5 minutes to shoot over and then spot the Lincoln at a red curb under the Twin Dragon Gateway to Chinatown. Bosch parked behind Haller's car, put on the flashers, and got out. He walked up and got in through the door behind the driver. Howler was in the opposite seat with his laptop computer open on a fold-down desk. Bosch knew he was stealing Wi-Fi from the Starbucks. There he is, the lawyer said. Boyd, why don't you go in and get a couple of lattes? You want anything, Harry? I'm good, Bosch said. Howler handed a $20 bill over the seat, and the driver got out of the car without a word and closed the door. Bosch and Howler were alone now. Bosch handed the package across the seat to him. Guard it with your life, Bosch said. Oh, I will, Howler said. I'm going to take it in straight from here. Going with Cellwright if that's okay with you. They are close, reliable, and AABB accredited. If you're okay with them, I'm okay with them. How will this work now? I get this in today, and we will probably hear yay or nay by Friday. Comparing grandparents to grandchild, we're talking about a 25% passage of chromosomes. That's a lot for them to work with. What about the stuff from Dominic? We wait on that. Let's see what the swabs got us first. Okay. And have you looked at the probate filing yet? Not yet, but I'll get it by the end of the day. I did hear that they're saying the decedent had no blood heirs. So what do? Well, we wait for confirmation from Cellwright, and if we get that, then we put our package together and seek an injunction. Which does what? We ask the court to stop the distribution of the estate. We say, hold on a minute, we have a valid heir and a holographic will and the means of proving authenticity. Then we brace ourselves for the onslaught. Bosch nodded. They'll come after us, Howler said. You, me, the heir, everybody. Make no mistake, we're all fair game. They'll try to make us out as charlatans. You can count on that. I warned Bibiana, Bosch said, but I don't think she understands how relentless they might be. Let's see how the DNA comes back. If that's what we think and she's the heir, then we'll circle the wagons and get her ready. We'll probably have to move her and hide her. She's got a kid. The kid too, then. She needs a big space for her work. Her work might need to be put on hold. Okay. Bosch didn't think that would go over well. I told her what you said about it being change the world money, he said. I think that's what pulled her in. Does every time. Howler bent down to look through the windows and see if his driver was waiting to get back behind the wheel. There was no sign of him. I heard in the CCB that you filed on the Dungeon Master, Howler said. Don't call him that, Bosch said. Makes it sound like a joke. And I know the woman he had down there in that place.
She's going to be dealing with the aftermath for a long time.
Sorry, I'm just a callous defense attorney.
Did he lawyer up yet?
I don't know, but I told you, you don't want that case. Guy's a soulless psychopath. You don't want to get near that.
True. This guy, he should get the death penalty, you ask me.
But he didn't kill anyone that we know about yet.
Out his window, Bosch saw the driver standing in front of the coffee shop. He was holding two coffee cups and waiting to be called back to the Lincoln. He appeared to Bosch to be looking across the street at something. Then he made a slight nod.
Did he just...
Bosch turned and peered out the back window of the Lincoln to try to see what the driver was looking at.
What? Haller said.
Your driver, Bosch said. How long have you had him?
Who, Boyd?
About 2 months now.
He one of your reformation projects?
Bosch now leaned forward to look past Haller and out his window. Haller had a history of taking on his clients as drivers in order to help them pay off their legal fees to him.
I've helped him through a couple of scrapes, Haller said. What's going on?
Did you mention Sellwright in his presence? Bosch asked in response.
Does he know where you're taking the samples?
Bosch had put two and two together. He had forgotten that morning to check his house and the street out front for cameras, but he remembered Creighton mentioning Haller during the confrontation in the lobby of the police station. If they knew about Haller, then they might also have him under surveillance. There could be a plan to intercept the DNA samples either before they reached Sellwright or once they had been turned in.
No, I haven't told him where we're going, Haller said.
I haven't spoken about it in the car. What's going on?
You are probably under surveillance, Bosch said, and he might be in on it. I just saw him nod to somebody.
Fucking A. Then his ass is grass. Hold on a second. Let's think about this.
Do you?
Wait. Haller put his hand up to stop Bosch from speaking. He then moved his laptop and folded up the desk. He got up and leaned over the seat toward the steering wheel. Bosch heard the air compression thump of the car's trunk opening. Haller got out of the car and went to the trunk. Soon Bosch heard it slam shut and Haller got back into the car with a briefcase. He opened the case and then opened a secret compartment inside it. There was an electronic device secreted in the space, and he turned on a switch, then put the case down on the seat between them. It's an RF jammer, he said. I take this baby in with me to every client meeting I have in the jail. You never know who's listening. If anybody's listening to us now, they're getting an earful of white noise.
Bosch was impressed.
I just bought one of those, he said, but it wasn't in a fancy briefcase. Took it as a partial fee payment from a former client. Cartel courier. He wasn't going to need it where he was going.
So what's your plan?
Do you know of another place to take the swabs?
Haller nodded.
California coding up in Burbank, he said. It was down to them or Sellwright, and Sellwright agreed to the push.
Give me back the package, Bosch said. I'll take the tubes to Sellwright. You take a phony package to California coding. Make them think that's where we're doing the analysis.
Bosch took the extra tubes containing swabs from Viviana and Gabriella out of his coat pocket. He didn't have an extra from Whitney Vance, so to sell the misdirection in case the tubes fell into the wrong hands, he used the Sharpie to change the initials marked on the tubes. He turned VV into WV and GL to the randomly chosen GE. He then signaled for the padded envelope. He removed the tubes containing swabs from Vance, Lita, and Veracruz and put them into his coat pocket. He then put the two altered tubes into the envelope and handed it back.
You take that to California coding and ask for a blind comparison, he said. Don't let on to your driver or anybody else you think you're being followed. I'll go to Sellwright.
Got it. I still want to kick his ass. Look at him over there. Bosch checked the driver again. He was no longer looking across the street.
There will be time for that later, and I'll help.
Haller was writing something on a legal pad. He finished, tore the page off the pad, and handed it to Bosch.
That's Sellwright in my contact there, Haller said. He's expecting the package.
Bosch recognized the address. Sellwright was out near Cal State LA, where the LAPD lab was located. He could get there in 10 minutes, but would take 30 to make sure he wasn't followed. He opened his door and turned to look back at Haller.
Keep that cartel briefcase close, he said.
Don't worry, Haller said. I will.
Bosch nodded.
After I drop this, I'm going to see Ida Towns Forsyth, he said.
Good, Haller said. We want her on our side.
Bosch got out just as Boyd came around to the driver's door. Bosch said nothing to him. He went back to his own car and sat behind the wheel and watched the intersection as Haller's Lincoln pulled onto Cesar Chavez and headed west. There was a lot of traffic moving through the intersection, but Bosch saw no vehicle that he thought was suspicious or that might be tailing the Lincoln.
Chapter 38. The drop-off at Cellwright went down without incident after Bosch took anti-surveillance measures that included driving completely around Dodger Stadium in Chavez Ravine. After hand-delivering the three tubes to Haller's contact, Bosch made his way over to the 5 freeway and headed north. Along the way, he diverted at the Magnolia exit in Burbank to continue his circuitous driving patterns and to grab a submarine sandwich at Giamella's. He ate in the car and kept his eyes on the comings and goings in the parking lot. He was putting the empty sandwich wrap back in the bag when his phone chirped, and he took a call from Lucia Soto, his former partner at LAPD. "How is Bella Lourdes?" she asked. Word had spread fast for a name not released publicly. "You know Bella?" he asked. "A little, from Las Hermanas." Bosch remembered that Soto was part of an informal group made up of Latina police detectives from all the departments in the county. There weren't many, so the group forged some tight bonds. "She never told me she knew you," he said. "She didn't want you to know she was checking you out with me," Soto said. "Well, she went through a lot, but she's tough. I think she'll be okay." "I hope so. It's an awful story." She waited a beat for him to start telling her the details, but Bosch kept quiet. She finally got the picture. "I heard you filed on the guy today," she said. "I hope you've got him dead to rights." "He's not going anywhere," Bosch said. "Good to hear. So, Harry, when are we going to have lunch and catch up? I miss you." "Damn, I just ate. But we'll do it soon. Next time I'm downtown. I miss you, too." "I'll see you, Harry." Bosch pulled out of the lot and followed a roundabout route west toward South Pasadena. He drove by Ida Town's Forsythe's home on Arroyo Drive 4 times over a spread of 30 minutes, each time noting the cars parked on the street and anything else that might indicate that Whitney Vance's longtime secretary and assistant was being watched. He saw no indicators of surveillance, and after a couple passes in the alley behind the house, he decided it was safe to knock on the door. He parked on a side street and walked around to Arroyo and up to the house. Forsythe's home was much nicer in person than on his viewing on Google Street View. It was a classic California craftsman that had been meticulously cared for. He stepped up onto a wide, long front porch and knocked on a coffered wood door. He had no idea whether Forsythe was home or still had duties to perform inside the Vance home. If that was the case, he was prepared to wait until she returned. But he didn't have to knock a second time. The woman he had come to see swung the door open and looked at him with eyes that did not register any familiarity. "Mrs. Forsythe?"
"It's Ms."
"I'm sorry, Miss Forsythe. Do you remember me? Harry Bosch? I came to see Mr. Vance last week." The recognition was there now.
"Of course. Why are you here?"
Well, first I wanted to express my sympathies. I know you and Mr. Vance worked together a long time."
"Yes, we did. It's been quite a shock. I know he was old and ill, but you don't expect a man of such power and presence to suddenly be gone."
"What can I do for you, Mr. Bosch?" "I guess whatever it is Mr. Vance had you investigating doesn't really matter anymore." Bosch decided that the best move would be the head-on approach. "I'm here because I want to talk to you about the package Mr. Vance had you mail to me last week." The woman in the doorway stood frozen for almost 10 seconds before answering. She looked fearful.
"You know that I'm being watched, right?" she said.
"No, I don't know that," Bosch said. "Before knocking, I looked and didn't see anyone. But if that's the case, you should invite me in. I parked around the corner. Right now, standing out front is the only giveaway that I'm here." Forsythe frowned, but then stepped back and opened the door wide.
"Come in," she said.
"Thank you," Bosch said. The entry room was broad and deep. She led Bosch down the length of it, and then into a rear sitting room off the kitchen, where there were no windows facing the street. She pointed to a chair.
What is it you want, Mr. Bosch?
Bosch sat down, hoping it would persuade her to do the same, but she remained standing. He did not want this to be an adversarial conversation.
Well, first I need to confirm what I said at the door, he said.
You did send that package to me, didn't you?
Her arms were folded now.
I did, she said, because Mr. Vance asked me to.
Do you know what was in it? Bosch asked.
I didn't at the time. I do now.
This immediately concerned Bosch. Had the corporate minders asked her about it?
How do you know now? He asked. Because after Mr. Vance passed and his body was taken, I was told to secure his office, she said. In doing so, I noticed that his gold pen was missing. That was when I remembered the heavy object in that package he asked to be sent to you.
Bosch nodded with relief. She knew about the pen. But if she didn't know about the will, then perhaps no one else did yet. That would give Haller an edge when he made his move with it.
What did Mr. Vance tell you when he gave you the package for me?
He told me to put it in my purse and to take it home with me. He said he wanted me to take it to the post office and mail it the next morning before coming to work. I did as I was told.
Did he ask you about it?
Yes. First thing when I came in that morning. I told him I had just been to the post office and he was pleased.
If I showed you the envelope that was addressed and sent to me, do you think you could identify it?
Probably. It had his handwriting on it. I would recognize that.
And if I write all of this as you have recounted it into an affidavit, would you be willing to sign it in front of a notary?
Why would I do that?
To prove that was his pen?
If you're going to sell it, I would like the opportunity to buy it from you. I would pay above market price.
It's not that. I'm not selling the pen. There was a document in the package that may become contested, and I may need to prove as well as I can how it came into my possession. The pen, which was a family heirloom, will be helpful in that process, but a signed affidavit from you would also be.
I don't want to get mixed up with the board of directors if that's what you're talking about. Those people are animals. They'll sell their own mothers for a piece of all that money.
You wouldn't be pulled in any deeper than you already are going to be, Ms. Forsythe. She finally moved to one of the other chairs in the room and sat down.
What do you mean by that? She said.
I have nothing to do with all of that. The document in the package has a handwritten will, Bosch said. It names you as a beneficiary. He studied her reaction. She seemed puzzled.
Are you saying I get money or something? She asked.
$10 million, Bosch said. Bosch saw her eyes flare for a moment at the realization that she was in line for some of the riches. She brought her right arm up and held a fist against her chest. Her chin came down, but Bosch could still see her lips tremble as tears came. Bosch wasn't sure how to read it. It was a long moment before she looked up at him and spoke.
I didn't expect anything, she said.
I was an employee.
I wasn't family.
Have you been going to the house this week? He asked.
No, not since Monday. The day after. That was when I was informed that my services were no longer needed.
And you were there Sunday when Mr. Vance died?
He called me and asked me to come in.
He said he had some letters he wanted to write.
He told me to come in after lunch, and I did.
I was the one who found him in his office when I got there. You were allowed to go back there unescorted?
Yes, I've always had that privilege.
Did you call for an ambulance?
No, because he was clearly dead.
Was he at his desk?
Yes, he died at his desk.
He was slumped forward and to the side a little bit. It looked like he went fast.
So you called security?
I called Mr. Sloan, and he came in and called someone on staff who had medical training. They tried CPR, but it didn't work.
He was dead.
Mr. Sloan then called the police. Do you know how long Mr. Sloan worked for Vance?
A long time, at least 25 years, I would say.
He and I were there the longest. She dabbed at her eyes with a tissue that seemed to Bosch to have materialized out of nowhere. When I met with Mr. Vance, he gave me a phone number and told me it was a cell phone, Bosch said. He said to call him if I made any headway with my investigation. Do you know what happened to that phone? She shook her head immediately.
I don't know anything about it, she said.
I called a few times and left messages, Bosch said. and Mr. Sloan called me on it as well. Did you see him take anything from the desk or the office after Mr. Vance died?
No. He told me to secure the office after they were